From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at your local wine store. 1 year ago this week, we were moving into the second month of the pandemic in this country, and so many businesses had temporarily closed. But your liquor store? It was open, maybe with curbside pickup, but open nonetheless. And sales were booming. Many liquor stores experienced monthly sales that were more like holiday times from last April through the fall. And there is data to back this up. Forbes reports that both alcohol and tobacco sales were dramatically higher in the United States last year. And while that was good news for some businesses, it was also an ingredient for abuse and addiction. A study from scientists at USC found that alcohol sales were up 34% in the first half of the pandemic. Tobacco sales, by the way, were up 13%. And with that, hospital admissions for alcohol-related conditions also went up. They started at Keck Hospital in Southern California, where admissions for cirrhosis or alcoholic hepatitis were up by 30% year over year. And the more the researchers looked around the country, the more alcohol-related disease they found. People are drinking more to deal with stress, to deal with boredom, to deal with loneliness. It's not inherently or always a problem, but it can be. And experts want us to talk more about it, even if that can be sensitive or difficult. Our guests this hour include Dr. Tim Wiegand, Associate Professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center, among other titles. Dr. Wiegand, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Kenneth Connor. Ken is a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center and doing some interesting research that we're going to talk about. Dr. Connor, welcome to you. Thank you for being with us.
Well, good afternoon.
Let me just start with Dr. Wiegand, because I think it was months back when we were talking about other subjects and you sort of virtually pulled us aside and said, at some point we're going to have to talk about alcohol. What have you seen in the last year, Tim?
Well, some interesting trends, unfortunately, as the pandemic hit, alcohol consumption dramatically increased. Availability, both from stores and through online sources, just surged. People were isolated at home and started drinking more. I recall very vividly, about a month into the pandemic, a gentleman that was admitted to the hospital, and he had been working, lost his position due to COVID, and he was a heavy drinker at night, but did not drink during the day, would go to work. And once he lost his position, he started drinking during the morning. He was isolated at home. And over the course of the month, he realized he was drinking heavier and heavier. He started to need to drink to stop the shakes. About a month in, he woke up in terror in the middle of the night, dripping with sweat. He realized he had to do something about this. He called his brother. His brother took him to the hospital, and he describes this, you know, really terrifying process of escalating drinking, not being able to do anything to stop it. And that was really just the tip of the iceberg. I realized, you know, this gentleman had the courage to, you know, reach out for help and some, you know, resources. He's able to get into the hospital and, you know, get stabilized for, you know, the withdrawal treatment and linked to ongoing treatment. But, you know, from every different perspective that I have, I saw increasing alcohol use and complications related to use.
Wow. Ken, can we talk about the research you've been doing, which, as I understand it, is, you know, not necessarily only about the pandemic here, but tell me about some of the work.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have a randomized clinical trial where we're testing the effectiveness of essentially a 45-minute phone conversation on treatment seeking in people who are drinking very frequently and have alcohol-related problems. Only about 8% or 10% of people who meet criteria for alcohol use disorder or even severe alcohol use disorder seek treatment, unfortunately, although there are good evidence-based treatments. So we have a study that's designed to test the question whether we can help facilitate people, you know, making that decision and following through with getting care. And we're recruiting people through social media here in the Rochester region, but also in Buffalo and Syracuse. So it's a simple study to find if anybody's or whoever's interested, or if you know somebody who might have an alcohol problem and they might be interested, they can simply Google UR alcohol study and learn about us and give us a call and see if you might be eligible or they might be eligible.
All right, so they're taking volunteers for the University of Rochester Alcohol Study. Listeners, I've got some emails already. I know listeners have been in touch with us this morning on this subject, but if you want to share your experiences, either concerns, questions, I know it can be sensitive, so if it's easier, you can send an email just talking about whether your drinking is increased since the start of the pandemic, or perhaps in a loved one. Has that been a way of sort of coping with stress or, as we mentioned, sort of filling time, changing routines? 844-295-TALK is the number to call, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. And Ken, if we could, can we talk about the questions you ask? Because I'm very curious to know, first of all, the people who are involved in this kind of a study, they must already suspect they do have a drinking problem. Do they have to be diagnosed with something? I mean, what are the sort of the criteria to get in?
Oh, sure. I think overwhelmingly the people in our project recognize that they're drinking too much and that it's created problems in their life. But they're often on the fence about whether or not to seek treatment for a variety of concerns they have about getting care. And so we work through those concerns that people might have. People are eligible if they meet a certain threshold of drinking and drinking-related problems. And many of the people in our study have severe struggles. They might be drinking every day a fair amount, but some people have much less difficulties, but nonetheless are concerned about their drinking or family members concerned. And, they're considering taking some action. In regards to your topic around COVID, we are asking some questions about the impact of COVID on people's alcohol use and how they're feeling. And I'm happy to share some of that information if you'd like.
Sure, please do.
Yeah. So we're asking our participants some questions that are specifically around their experience of COVID. And so people are answering, about half of the people in our study are answering moderately, quite a bit, or extremely to questions about being quarantined and self-isolating, worried about that, their physical health, worries about their mental health being affected, and their financial security. But the biggest worry or the biggest concern that people are expressing is that their alcohol use is being affected. And in fact, 82% of the people in our study, and these are people residing here in Monroe County and throughout upstate New York, 82% are perceiving that their drinking has changed associated with COVID. And overwhelmingly, the report is that they're saying that they're drinking more. And typically the explanation is that they're at home, they're not working, or they're working less. They're bored or isolated, and their alcohol consumption is increased because of that. There are other individuals who are also saying that stress associated with COVID is also driving their alcohol consumption. But the typical scenario seems to be I'm stuck at home. I've got more time on my hand, less structure in my life. I'm not able to work or do what I normally do, and drinking has come to replace some of that time, and I find it getting out of control.
So if I could, can I ask both of you, because in a moment, if you don't mind, Ken, I'd love to know the exact questions you're asking. But I want to understand something here. You know, Dr. Wiegand, so my kind of daily routine, I'm probably like a lot of people. My routine involves a cup of coffee first thing. an afternoon coffee when I leave the office, a glass of wine or a cocktail with dinner. It's almost like those three drinks are benchmarks throughout the day during this pandemic, because they're almost like guardrails to a day in a pandemic. And I don't say that flippantly. I mean, I'm not drinking to excess. I'm not necessarily drinking more. But it's interesting that in my own life, I think, boy, that cup of coffee is so important in the morning and in the afternoon. And then, you know, and maybe some people feel like that, that, you know, as Ken said, they're either bored or they're filling the time with something, et cetera. How do you know, Tim, when it becomes something more than just that? How do you know when this is beyond what I'm handling, or I should be worried about this, or I should be worried about a loved one or a friend or a family member?
Well, certainly, you know, you have a routine and you're still working, obviously. And, you know, just reflecting on the routine, I think, is useful for all of us. You know, when someone is drinking to cope with, you know, their feelings, when they're drinking to cope with symptoms of withdrawal, that's, you know, more extreme, you know, sign that the drinking is out of control, and they're adding other substances to that. When they're getting into arguments, I mean, the quarantine, you know, people have either lost jobs or been forced to work with from home. There's a lot of stress. It can be due to online education and challenges with the children, and, you know, parents are becoming teachers. There's in numerous different reasons why people may have stress. And if you're turning to the alcohol to combat that, or other people are commenting that, you know, you're a different person, that's a time to really reevaluate the consumption. Certainly having a glass of wine or two, you know, at times, or having, you know, a drink a day is not a problem. Not all alcohol use is a problem. Not all coffee use is a problem.
Sure.
But when you get into a routine that's really affecting your ability to function in other areas, or affecting your family members or your health in general, ability to perform tasks, and yourself or others can see it, you start to question it, that's a sign of concern. The alcohol consumption increased dramatically. Spirits rose, the sales rose by over 30% early in the pandemic. I think some of that was initial concern that the alcohol stores, liquor stores, would not be considered essential. They were in New York State and other states. Some were not. There was still beer and wine available in, for example, Pennsylvania I believe grocery stores or outlet stores. Wine sales increased by a third, and beer by 15%. And as I mentioned, the online sales and home delivery increased, but from March of 2020 to April of 2020, there was a nearly 500% increase in online sales. And in other mechanisms, a home delivery, Grubhub, DoorDash, where you don't really have skilled individual skilled in identifying, is an individual underage? Should I check for ID? Should I, how do I recognize if someone may have already had too much and maybe I don't deliver the alcohol with the rest of the food? They're put in a very difficult situation. And so we saw a lot of underage drinking increases as well as individuals that really shouldn't have continued to have access to alcohol at certain points of time, and bad stuff happened in that context. But, you asked some really good questions, and, you know, I just think, you know, reflecting on one's habits and are they healthy or not is really useful in general during times of stress. And
yeah, I think that's well said. Ken, how do you, before I get Leslie in Rochester on the phone, how do you see that question, Ken, starting to differentiate between even an increase in drinking? Because, you know, I asked the question on social media this morning for listeners, are you drinking more in the pandemic? And some people are answering very honestly and saying, yes. That doesn't mean that they're saying I'm drinking to excess, or I've lost control of it, or it's impacting my life in negative ways. But, you know, that line will start to blur at some point. How do you see it, Ken?
Sure. One trick a person might use is just to start keeping track of their alcohol consumption. And actually, that's people have began to use that just to assess alcohol use, so that people could self-assess their own use. But they found that that's a pretty powerful technique to change drinking behavior, and for people to recognize, gosh, this is I didn't realize how much I was drinking, how much I was leaning on it. And So just not only reflecting on one's use, but actively keeping track can be a useful technique to sort of catch this as it's happening. Essentially, you know, everybody's different, but if you begin to think or suspect that there's a problem, there probably is. And oftentimes with alcohol use disorder or alcohol-related problems, other people can recognize it before we can recognize it ourselves. So that can be another useful indicator if, you know, family members are expressing concern or people at work or people in your life. Effectively, if the drinking becomes a preoccupation, if a person feels they have lack of control over it, if they're more or less rearranging their day or their schedule to make sure they can drink, if they're preoccupied with having a supply of alcohol, you know, these are sort of some of the major benchmarks mm-hmm. for an alcohol-related problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting to think about if we were to actually log our what we drink, what we intake. I mean, that's always interesting for your own diet if you're trying to figure out what you're eating. Sometimes there's surprises in terms of amounts of food. I'm sure there could be surprises in amounts of drinking. Again, I don't say this intentionally humorously, but I will say on the occasional Sundays where I'm sheepish or embarrassed about taking my recycling bin to the curb because the neighbors will observe a number of bottles, not always me, you know, sometimes people hanging out, but you know, on those occasions where you think, all right, that was a little much. I wonder what the neighbors would think. That shows you the power of self-reflection. And now when Ken says, you know, make an actual log of it, I'm sure that would be powerful to do. I think it would be very strong. Leslie in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Leslie.
Hi there. I just have had my own personal observation, and I would like to get any kind of data confirmation, et cetera, from either of the guests today. I am a parent of a 17-year-old, and I have noticed an incredible uptake of alcohol consumption in the form of spritzers, be it Corona, Budweiser. It seems like every beer company now has their own take on these spritzers. But what is most concerning to me, because adolescents will perhaps experiment, we all know that, but is the leniency and almost acceptance of these types of drinks by their parents. At any given time, I can, you know, see in my, you know, my own child's friend's recycling bin, you know, tons and tons of cans, because there was a little party. I have found them under my son's man cave couch. Like they're sneaking them into my house. So I just kind of want to see if there's any, you know, am I alone in this, or are either of the guests seeing this uptick with adolescent alcoholism?
Yeah, Leslie, to be clear, it sounds to me like you're asking two questions. Just in general, the permissiveness of parents, and number two, the actual drinks themselves, the spritzer phenomenon, so to speak. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I appreciate the call. Thank you. Dr. Wiegand, I'll start with you. Is there any increase that you're aware of, anecdotally or numbers-wise, that indicates parents are more permissive with their minor children drinking? Let's start there.
Well, let me answer first. I mean, there's an increase in the spritzers. They're very popular.
Oh.
People like them for a variety of reasons, and it's interesting. I've seen them not just in underage drinking, but you know, across the continuum, and including patients that have really severe alcohol use disorder. You know, every once in a while, I'm surprised that it's not just the vodka, but it's 12 of the forget the cider spritzers that they really prefer and go through an awful lot of them. So they are very popular. I think that the perception, even the marketing, the way that the can appears, it just seems to be a less benign kind of form of alcohol, and parents can get into this. Well, at least it's not, they're not drinking vodka, or they're not drinking Natty Daddy, or they're not out with their friends, you know, drinking, you know, shots and things like this. But it is alcohol is alcohol, and it's very easy to, you know, those drinks are not really bitter, like drinking a, you know, concentrated form of liquor, and they go down very easily, almost like a fruit juice. We saw this years ago with the first kind of Four Loko and fruit flavored, fairly high concentration alcohol drinks that were very inexpensive, marketed to kind of look like energy drinks. And, you know, teens and underage drinking, the marketing even from the industry, you know, targeted that age group as, you know, an introduction to alcohol in a different form that was more palatable, more exciting. And so, yes, I've definitely seen increases. And, you know, this is alcohol is alcohol. You know, that the younger you're exposed to it, you have a environment, genetics, and the drug really kind of can come together in the wrong confluence in an individual to, for that individual to develop problems. So certainly, you know, these are not drinks to feed, you know, or to, you know, offer 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds. And if your teens are congregating, getting together, you know, and, you know, drinking with spritzers, be concerned, you know, the same as I would be as if that, you know, I noticed half of the, you know, bottle of whatever liquor missing from the cabinet.
Okay. Kenneth Connor, what do you think?
I don't know if I have a lot to add to Tim's comment. I'm a parent myself, and my kids are a little younger than Leslie's, but, you know, that's certainly a major preoccupation of mine as a parent is worried about substance use in children as they get older. And, you know, it's a real concern that substances are our major killer of adolescents, unfortunately, due to overdose, due to unintentional injuries, typically car accidents. And it's a scary time as a parent, you know, and in terms of, you know, very big picture patterns, there is some good news that adolescents today are drinking significantly less than they were 30, 40 years ago. You know, the cohort that I grew up in. And I do think that there's more appreciation generally that alcohol is a drug, that it can be dangerous, that, you know, alcohol is not just a casual thing. Now everybody shares that concern, but you know, the overall trend over decades is better for alcoholic drinking in youth than it was some decades ago. Now that doesn't hold for some other drugs. Certainly, you know, opioids are more available and more in use in youth than they were at that time, and that's a major concern. And alcohol remains, just a major problem with abuse in teens, et cetera. So, you know, I share your concern, Leslie, as a parent. And I personally think that, being firm about that, having conversations with youth and setting expectations around alcohol use is really important. Oftentimes teens will say that, you know, everybody's doing it, all my friends are doing it. And that's sort of almost a kind of a card people will play. And oftentimes that's their genuine perspective. But there can be real misperceptions around that. And oftentimes the teens that are saying that are drifting to hanging out with heavier users of alcohol, and there's some sort of affiliation there, because the truth is that most teens are not abusing alcohol, and things are improved in comparison to what they once were. So anyway, that's some perspective.
Okay. Paul in Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, thank you. I have more of a comment than an alcohol related question. And my concern is today's topic may be just one of these tip of the iceberg situations where we're going to find out that there's almost like a PTSD COVID response that we're going to see over the next few years. And it makes me very pessimistic that there's going to be a return to put any kind of quotation marks around that you want the word normal. I'm just concerned, maybe it's because of my age, but I'm just concerned that we're going to see things that are going to be almost like, not to over-exaggerate, but almost like out of a, like a warlike setting with some people's mental states when this is, if it is over. So sorry to be so pessimistic, but it's kind of a gray, rainy day, and that's the mood I'm in. So thank you very much, and have a good day.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul. Dr. Wiegand, are you concerned about that?
Well, I think, you know, data and understanding of, you know, what we're facing can also drive, you know, forces of change. And, you know, he's right. In June of 2020, 40% of adults identified increases in problems related to mental health or substance use disorder. 31% of adults reported symptoms of anxiety and depression, 26% trauma, 13% had increases in substance use, and 11% had seriously contemplated suicide. And that's a survey of U.S. adults, which is really grim data. When you couple the problems with isolation, the stress from all of the factors of COVID, the unemployment and everything else, along with increasing increases in substance use. And we're focusing on alcohol today, but, you know, there's really problems in every area of addiction treatment and substance use where we've noticed really adverse outcomes. The overdose epidemic related to opioids, which had started to subtly decrease in 2018, has shown the greatest single year numbers from May of 2020 to May of 2021, I believe, is 81,000 fatalities related to opioids, mostly driven by synthetic opioids. At the same time, with some of the funding coming out from the federal government and the state government, there is a focus on mental health and addiction, and it really needs to be a big focus to get, you know, the programs up and running on site as able to leverage new technologies. I mean, there's been some benefits certainly to come out of COVID, the increasing use and availability of telemedicine to access care for addiction services as well as mental health, to start patients on medications and regulation changes that we hope will stay in existence, the ability to start buprenorphine, for example, via a telephone and telemedicine consultation without having to have someone come on site, allows us a greater reach to start medications for opioid use disorder, for example. The use of certain detoxification techniques, ambulatory detoxification for alcohol withdrawal in appropriate individuals when one has the skill to do so and the right setting for the patients. And earlier, tracking was mentioned. There's a surge in online applications for not just tracking consumption, but for also checking in, daily pledge, checking in with others if you're continuing to use substances, to decrease the risk of overdose or complication. One can send even a sensor with their phone that if they don't activate it, it sends a signal to 911 to activate EMS if they're using opioids, for example. The online availability of NA and AA, certainly some individuals prefer to come on site and to have that connection, but we're also noticing an increase in ways to connect in the broad new context that do have benefits. I think when you combine that and we do get back to normal, you know, this new versus the old, you know, hopefully we'll buffer some of the concerns that were brought up. But yes, we are facing a crisis of mental health and substance use. And, you know, we need to have the workforce, the skill, and also the recognition and the support financially and, you know, at the institution level, the public health, the city, the state level to face it and to help people.
We're talking about alcohol sales, consumption, and concerns about alcohol-related illness, disease, and addiction with our guest, Dr. Tim Wiegand, who is a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and Kenneth Connor. Dr. Connor is a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Sales are way up in the last year for alcohol, and we've seen admissions to various hospitals across the country rise when it comes to alcohol-related illnesses or disease. So the numbers are there. We know why a lot of the cases are happening the way they are. I mean, it's certainly not there's no magic involved here. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. But the question is, what do we do about this? Is it changing? And what do our listeners want to know about this? Kenneth Connor's group is continuing their study. And if you want to be involved, you can still get involved. And we'll tell you again before the end of the hour how you can get involved with that. And when we come back from this only break of the hour, we'll take more of your phone calls. If you're on the line, we can hang there. And I also want to ask Kenneth Connor about the questions that are asked directly. So if you're thinking about getting involved in this kind of study, what does he want to know about your consumption habits? We'll talk about that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we hear a lot from remote workers who say that after the pandemic ends, they still want to work remotely. But what does that mean for the future of office space? There's a lot of companies that have been doing things remotely. What if they never return? What happens to all that space? There's a lot of work to do to reimagine what those spaces look like, and it is already underway. We'll explore it Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kenneth Connor, once again, tell listeners if they want to get involved in this study, how they can volunteer.
Sure. You can simply Google or use any search engine and type in UR alcohol study, and you'll find us. And you can either fill out some information online and submit it, or just call us or text us at the study number. And we're studying adults with alcohol related problems who reside in the greater Rochester area and as far west as Buffalo and as far east as Syracuse.
Okay. What are the questions you're going to get asked if you're in this study?
Sure. We do ask about if a person seems to have some alcohol related difficulties. So we'll ask about alcohol consumption and related problems, things like conflicts with family or impacts on work or physical health, as well as, you know, perception that the drinking is becoming too much or is becoming more of a pattern than I intended. Probably the most detailed thing we ask about is ultimately if somebody enrolls in our study is how much they've drank in the past 30 days. And we'll actually go through with the person on a day-to-day basis how many drinks of alcohol they had on each day, which might sound like an overwhelming task. I mean, how could I possibly remember that, et cetera? But we really walk people through that process and think about, you know, the weekends and think about any special events that occurred in the last 30 days. And it's remarkable how able people are to sort of recreate their drinking. And as we were talking about earlier, often, you know, sort of a light bulb just goes on through that process of reflecting on drinking and gaining an appreciation for, you know, how much of a problem it might be. And then once somebody's enrolled in our study, we then follow up with them at, on a regular basis, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months to check in with them again about their general health. So we ask about how things are going in a general sense in terms of their lifestyle and working and their physical health, any pain they're experiencing, along with more detailed questions about their drinking.
So, you know, Kenneth, when you think about conflict with family, if you're asking people in the study if they have conflict with family, there takes some real self-awareness in some cases because, you know, I think we all have probably experienced some situations, or many of us have, where someone may have an addiction problem, an alcohol issue, but isn't either admitting that or seeing the strain or the stress it's putting on family. Now, maybe they are. Maybe some people are saying, I don't want this anymore. I don't want to deal with how this makes me feel. I want to change. But in other cases, you may ask, you know, a spouse and they'll say, yes, you know, my spouse has a drinking problem. But if you ask the person with the ostensible drinking problem, they might say, no, I'm fine. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Right. You know, that's a very common circumstance where a spouse or somebody's parent, we were talking with Leslie earlier, or somebody else in somebody's network is essentially more concerned about their drinking maybe than the person is themselves. And, you know, that's a complicated scenario. It you know, when you think about drinking and you think about, you know, why any of us drink, you know, it can be a relief. It can feel like a reward. It can help us relax or socialize. And people who develop a drinking problem really learn to rely on alcohol for those reasons. And so it can be very difficult for them to think about, you know, giving that up or making a change. And people can develop blinders or become defensive, you know, around that. And then, as Tim was saying earlier, you know, some people can do develop, you know, really a really severe drinking pattern where they'll get sick if they stop drinking mm-hmm. all of a sudden and go into withdrawal. And so that can be a real concern. I was, you know, Tim and I both worked with somebody earlier this week who was trying to get into treatment for his alcohol withdrawal. And that's not always the easiest process to get that kind of help and get started. So we gave him a nudge in some direction and he was able to get the help he needed. So anyway, you're right. People with the problem can be slower to recognize it than others. And that can be a difficult thing to sort of navigate and work through.
Yeah. And Dr. Wiegand, if you see someone in the hospital, literally in an emergency setting, for alcohol, you know, alcohol poisoning, overdose, et cetera. I have witnessed people in my life who spent years denying a problem existed, you know, certainly to others, but maybe even to themselves, to the extent where individual health scares. And I don't want to be too specific, but were described to family as something other than being alcohol related until there was a near death experience. And then it was sort of that was sort of the getting religion on it. But it took that extreme of an event. And it was very difficult for family who maybe either suspected or were scared or didn't know how to intervene. And you also wonder if the person who has the problem knows it or is admitting it to themselves. So I guess I'm curious, Dr. Wiegand, when you see someone who ends up in an emergency setting, is there often surprise either on their behalf or from their loved ones that this has happened or not, I guess? I mean, does that happen where people say, I had no idea it had gone this far?
There's a variability, certainly, in terms of recognition. Often people really do, you know, realize the key is the natural inclination is to, you know, deny or to, you know, try and cover up for most people. I mean, there's still a lot of stigma associated with mm-hmm. this. People feel genuinely I failed myself or my family. I'm less of a person. And you got to recognize that addiction is a disease of the reward circuit. It's not a moral failing. And there are treatments and ways to get better. And medical professionals need to do a better job of understanding how they can, you know, identify with patients, establish rapport, reassure them that, you know, there's not a problem with the patient. They have a disease that's treatable, and also really identify when, you know, presentation, maybe it's pancreatitis, maybe it's a fall, maybe it's a car accident, may have been substance related. And, you know, that's the real problem. It's not, yes, true fall, you have pancreatitis, you have this other complication, but the problem was really related to drugs and alcohol. And that's where we need to really work on increasing education and awareness at all levels of medical education so that the providers, from nurses to physicians to the addiction experts, have more skill in prevention, treatment, you know, screening for substance use disorders and addiction.
Well, on that subject, let me get Peter in Rochester. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Yeah, I was just thinking it's kind of ironic that in our culture where sober people are, you know, looked at as teetotalers or you can't handle it, this, that, and the other. The only place you're going to find real sobriety and support are in the NA and the AA groups of other people that have been in those shoes. You know, we have a culture that, through capitalism, what have you, just we have a buzz culture that's encouraged. It's like, you know, a rite of passage. And we had a nephew. He wanted to come back because he failed out of Buffalo. And we're like, no, you're on team party. I'm on team sober. You need to, like, man up and fix this. And so we're estranged. And, you know, it's a tremendous burden on families because they have to draw a hard line. And a lot of times they're ill-equipped, but that's what that is. And I also want to say that, you know, Carrie Nation was onto something. She saw families just get ground into dirt, and what a pair she had to go into bars with bricks and hatchets and rip places up. It's amazing she wasn't killed sooner. So, thank you.
Peter, I appreciate the phone call. Dr. Wiegand, can I start with you on that?
Yeah, certainly, you know, strong feelings, and, you know, I, you know, appreciate the, you know, the sobriety and the, you know, motivation to, you know, stay that way. What I have noticed, though, is that, you know, there are cohorts that certainly there's a lot of peer pressure and, you know, the party scene, but more and more people really respect the decision if someone is, you know, willing to say, no, I'm not going to drink, or no, I'm not going to use, you know, whatever, you know, marijuana or whatever substance, you know, I'm the driver. No, I just don't have that in my life. And I think people have recognized as there overall is less stigma associated with addiction. Still need to go a long way, but people respect when someone says, that's just not for me. It's still hard to do that. And it's still in, you know, there's different settings, friends, environments where that's really difficult to do, and individuals may not recognize the harm that it's causing them. And, you know, people like, you know, our listener can see that from afar, that it's clearly a problem, and their two lives are not going to mix together. But I have noticed, you know, more individuals willing to say, look, that's just not what's part of me anymore. Or, you know, even identifying that they've struggled in the past and really don't want to go back to you know, former struggles with alcohol or other substances, that are more willing to talk about it. And I really, you know, give those, you know, individuals kudos, and, you know, they've, you know, come to become competent with themselves, and you know, that helps others really recognize as well.
Kenneth, you want to add to that? I mean, I take Peter's point that there could be falling out among family members. I know what he's trying to say. I don't know how I feel about the idea that someone needs to man up. Now, there's a difference, I think, if someone is literally dealing with addiction. Telling them just to man up is probably not all that helpful. If someone is just making bad choices and is either lazy or reckless, I mean, that's, I take that point. What do you think, Kenneth?
Oh, you know, really difficult issues, because somebody with an alcohol use problem can affect other people's lives, and you know, can make things difficult for other people within the family or within their network, either due to irresponsibility or their behavior when intoxicated or what have you. So some of those perceptions can be real. I think that it is important to keep in mind that you know, alcohol use disorder, alcoholism is very treatable, that we have excellent evidence-based treatments now to go along with Alcoholics Anonymous that the caller mentioned as supports. And so, you know, I think a lot of times with addiction, there's a feeling of hopelessness or the person will never change. And we just don't know that that's the case. You know, people always can surprise us. And, you know, it's the same sort of phenomenon with quitting smoking. It usually doesn't happen the first time or the second time. But with more quit attempts and with more support and use of more strategy, people are ultimately successful. And the same is true of addiction recovery. So recovery rates from addiction and response to treatment, adherence to treatment, et cetera, is as good as with other chronic diseases, no matter, you know, what have you, obesity or diabetes or other chronic conditions. And so, you know, there's really no reason to think this person can't get better ultimately and can't respond to intervention. So you know, I think it's important to not give up on a person, although, you know, their behavior might be extremely frustrating or, you know, exasperating because they can't seem to see what is obvious to everyone else.
Let me get Rick.
Very hard to not,
yeah, go ahead, Dr. Wiggins.
I was going to say, it's very hard to not look at this as an all or none, you know, sober or not process. But then, you know, that's not really considering it like other diseases. We don't look at diabetes as, you know, your hemoglobin A1C is at 6 or it's, you know, the people can have improvements in diet and exercise and lifestyle that affect the disease that we can really reflect back on and say you're headed in the right direction. And I think that's really important to consider when someone is truly struggling with substance use disorder addiction, that there's a continuum of change and improvement. And, you know, sometimes for individuals, it takes a period of time. And the approach to one individual may be very different to another in terms of what really works, combinations of medication, counseling, just getting out of one's environment versus, you know, confrontation with family sometimes. And it varies. There are evidence-based treatments that, you know, we have identified that work better than others, but, you know, individuals really respond, you know, differently to a range of treatment options. And it's really a continuum of improvement that we really need to focus, not all or none.
Let's get Rich in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan. How are you doing?
Good, sir.
I listen to this stuff. I mean, I've spent a lot my life, unfortunately, through family, and I've dealt a lot with alcoholism. But as a person, I literally have never drank. I think it's amazing. I do marvel at the people who stop. People say to me, "Wow, it's amazing that you never drank." But it's like, "Well, I've never done anything." So there's nothing extraordinary about not drinking. But to drink and then to stop, I just think not only the physical part, just the social part, just the emotional part of the entire activities that go along with drinking. And I think that's something that people seem to miss too, besides just the fact that they're physically addicted to just all the other stuff that it entails.
Do you feel like you get a lot of credit because you don't drink?
Yeah, I think I get too much credit. I always tell people I've never done it. Now I can say when I was younger, there was like when you're a teenager, come on, man, drink. But then it got to the point where people wouldn't even, my friends wouldn't offer me. In fact, they're like, don't even offer him. They almost defended me. So I don't think, yeah, I think I get way too much credit for not drinking.
Hmm. Well, Rich, I appreciate that, Rich. And I, you know, to Rich's point, Dr. Wiegand, when Rich says there's a difference between me, I've never drank, and someone to stop, I mean, physiologically, it's just a huge difference, isn't it?
Well, it depends on, you know, the intensity.
Well, I should say it can be.
Yeah, but there definitely is an interesting difference if somebody has a substance use disorder and, you know, is dependent on alcohol, you know, from the point where they need it to avoid withdrawal symptoms. That's very difficult. Even craving to the point where, they have a problem with alcohol and they use excessively or it's impacted their life, but they're using it in certain settings, that can be very difficult due to craving and the reward circuits. Addiction is a disease of the reward circuit, and those two reward circuits from the individual that just decided never drinking wasn't going to be a part of his life. No, I don't drink. I just never interested me. To someone who's going to stop, it's very different. And, you know, that's why, you know, it's considered a disease when somebody has an alcohol use disorder.
Yeah. Let me squeeze in a couple more here. Roger says, why are alcoholics blamed solely for family conflicts? Are the sober people around them always blameless? Roger, it's a very fair question. We are all complex individuals, and the last thing I want to imply is that any family conflict that includes someone with alcoholism is because of the person with alcoholism. There's a lot of different reasons for that. And thank you for that note on that. Now, Roger follows up to say, I have struggled with alcohol for many years. I have also been a drug and alcohol counselor at one of our local clinics. The frustration I had as a counselor was that the main focus was always reimbursement by Medicaid and treatment suffered. Kenneth, any concern about that? You know, that people who need the treatment aren't getting it for various reasons?
You know, I'm gonna defer to Tim on that because he's much closer to that reimbursement issue than I am. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, Tim.
Well, you know, you hope that's not the focus, but programs do need to stay open, and you know, there's continuously cuts, and you know, I hope that you know, what's coming down the pipe in the future due to budget cuts and shortfalls don't jeopardize treatment. But you know, Rochester does have a lot of treatment options. There's a lot of treatment programs that are open and accepting patients. Medications are typically covered by Medicaid that we use for alcohol use disorder. You know, the key is identifying someone that can, you know, work with you. We have a lot of free resources in Rochester, from peer resources to recovery centers, Recovery Fitness, to lots of meetings. There are access challenges, just like we have across, and disparities just as we have across the continuum of healthcare that need to be revisited and addressed. And, you know, it's a work in progress, and really hope that that's not the perception and not, you know, the reality, but that I know programs are, you know, looking at finances all the time, trying to figure out how do we have the more counselors, how do we best serve our patients, mm-hmm. and how do we do so while staying open.
Well, to anyone struggling, I hope that that you feel love and support, and that you don't deal with stigma or shame. I know it can be difficult. And so I want to thank our guests for their insight as we talk about alcohol, especially during the pandemic, but in general. Dr. Tim Wiegan, great having you, sir. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Kenneth Connor, who is a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and helping round up research for still looking for volunteers, University of Rochester Alcohol Study. You can still get in. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And to all of the team here, Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer, I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend. We are back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.